Hello and welcome to the Cybersecurity Sessions Season 2. I'm Danny Middleton-Wren and I am your brand new host of the Cybersecurity Sessions and I am Head of Media here at Netasea. So today we're going to be talking about AI, ticket scalping and Russian bots. Specifically, we're going to be discussing the ethics and legalities of scraping for AI, the PIMAI and Clearview facial recognition scandals. We'll be talking about the Eurovision ticket scalping fracas from earlier this year, ahead of the actual Eurovision final on May the 13th. We'll be discussing the relationship between queuing and bots, and then on to how Russian bots are feeding disinformation into our social media feeds, as well as the Vulcan file leaks. So before we kick off, I would like to introduce our extremely insightful panel of experts that we have on hand today, starting with Matthew Gracie McMinn.
Hi, Danny. Thanks for having me here today. I'm Matthew Gracie McMinn, and I head up threat research here at Netasea.
Thank you, Matt. Next, we have Chris.
Hi, Danny. I'm Chris Pace, and I head up marketing and product marketing here at Netasea.
Lovely. And on to Tom.
Hi, Danny. My name's Tom. I'm one of the bot specialists here at Netasea, and I've been here since we founded the company.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Tom. And that is, for anybody who's unaware, 2018. So Tom's been with us for quite a while. Okay, so let's jump into topic number one. So we're going to be talking about Clearview AI. Clearview AI has come into some trouble recently after scraping nearly 30 billion images from platforms such as Facebook without users' permission. Matt, do you want to talk about why this is relevant, why this has caused such a furore?
So there's quite a lot of different reasons why people are quite angry about this, and it largely depends on your perspective, whether you're an individual user of Facebook or if you're, say, a government regulator. So if we start with sort of individual users, obviously you upload things to Facebook, you don't expect private companies to go and gather that information and then essentially sell that information on to other people.
Although that is Facebook's entire business model that you just described.
It is.
So they totally should expect that, but we don't expect that.
No, we don't expect that.
And these guys aren't paying Facebook either, which is probably part of the issue.
It's the publicly accessible parts of Facebook, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's the publicly accessible parts of Facebook. And it's not just Facebook, though. They're hitting all sorts of social media sites. They're just trying to grab as much information and they're cross-referencing it in order to sort of find every instance of your picture appearing on the internet, as it were. Government regulators are, of course, also quite angry about this because it's quite clearly in breach of certain data privacy laws. Data privacy laws are very complex, particularly when you're crossing international borders. The GDPR was an attempt to standardize countries within the EU. Even then, each country has its own interpretation. There's the UK GDPR, the Data Privacy Act. You have a different one in Germany, a different one in France, a different one in Italy. So it gets very complex when you start working across international borders. And of course, Clearview got into a lot of trouble in Europe for breach of GDPR, essentially.
So, and that is because there is a provision in GDPR, therefore, then, that your face is your personal data.
Absolutely. It is classed as biometric data, particularly when you're using it for identification purposes. And that is a special category of data underneath the GDPR, which means it's subject to extra protections and does require the knowledge of the person whose data has been collected and also, in many cases, their consent.
These guys first came onto the scene in like 2020 when it came to light that they'd scraped these 20 billion faces. And there was a bit of controversy then. But I'm assuming that they must have believed this was a grey enough area that they were going to get away with this.
I suspect that that's very much the case. They thought it was a grey enough area. There's also a lot of misunderstandings around the GDPR, and not many people realise it's actually extraterritorial. So I think PIMAI's made that argument that they're not actually EU-based, so they shouldn't be subjected to the UK data protection law or any sort of EU one. However, these laws are written specifically to be extraterritorial and to account for the fact that the internet crosses international borders.
But there's a more interesting legal dynamic about this, right? In the US, lots of different agencies and jurisdictions have fined and actually banned the use of Clearview. However, in those same jurisdictions, the law enforcement forces are paying for subscriptions of this service. Yeah. So you have both the legal aspect where they're saying that this is not right, they're getting fined, they're saying it's legal, but then actually those same law enforcement officers actually using the service to find criminals.
Yeah, and I would guess that's what adds controversy to this, is because the kind of individual, for example, who is, you know, concerned about their privacy, but the likelihood is they are very keen to ensure that it's not being used by law enforcement or by central governments or by, you know, government agencies generally, because that's the whole purpose of them wanting to protect their privacy. So the fact that ClearView is a system marketed and sold to law enforcement agencies makes the whole thing even messier, really, in lots of ways. I think I also heard that the efficacy of the thing itself is called into question anyway, because a large percentage of the data that they have is of white faces. And so therefore, it has a particularly bad record in identifying individuals that are of different ethnicity. And so that's a whole other problem that it has. And of course, that's all, I guess that's because the vast majority of faces that appear on those social networks are also white faces. So it's like a self-fulfilling thing. It's almost designing itself to not work as well because of where it's getting its data from.
Yeah, exactly. There's also the question around AI poisoning attacks. So this is a new area of cybersecurity. A lot of people are currently exploring the idea of, can you pollute data sets? Like you said, you know, it's not very good at people of ethnicities. In a similar manner, could you potentially poison the data set in there? Could I upload images of, say, myself with someone else's name attached and then commit crimes and so forth and essentially create a whole fake identity, or attach that to someone else and potentially try and frame them if I attach all of their personal details to my images and that goes to...
I think I've seen this movie.
What was it? I think Shia LaBeouf was in it.
What was it? There's a movie that is basically this entire concept, right? There's a fake identity that frames another individual for doing things that it turned out that he didn't do. Anyway, I can't remember.
Well, it doesn't even need to be fake. So you mentioned, Chris, that it's just like criminals that are really concerned that people want to hide the privacy, right? There was an American male last December who was arrested in one state. They wouldn't tell him why he was arrested. He spent 6 days in jail, had to hire two different legal counsels, one in each state. He was moved to another state. He was not told why he was imprisoned. It took the majors to figure out why, and it turned out that actually it's suspected that facial recognition profiled him, tagged him up as someone who'd committed a crime in another state. He was sent to that state, and it wasn't until the actual solicitor went and looked at the video that he could actually tell, hey, this guy looks a bit like, from the face, my client, my defendant, but his body, his build, everything else was completely different. It clearly was not him. It cost this guy thousands of dollars, and he spent 6 days in jail because he was misidentified by this technology, right?
This is the problem. When the volumes of data are so massive, there are going to be, surely, anomalies like that. There have to be, don't there? Because although people's faces are unique up to a point, they're not as unique as a fingerprint. Lots of people can look the same or similar. How clever does the machine have to be to know that it's definitely that individual? In fact, they don't commit to knowing it's that individual. They basically, you know, clearly themselves call it a decent guess at that person. And the problem is, the more reliant a law enforcement agency becomes on it, the more difficult it's going to be to suggest that it could be wrong.
We are years away from people being sent down for crimes because AI incorrectly identified them, right?
But it's a possibility.
It's going to happen at some point. Yeah, the system's never going to be perfect, right? Like, people spend a long time in jail before cases are even brought to trial. Like, who's to say that we don't see this happen more and more often?
I have a question about how easy is it for them to do what they did. So we've understood that the legality of the GDPR has been applied to say, look, that thing you did, you shouldn't have done. That's one thing, finding them. But technically, how hard was it for them to go and scrape those 20 billion faces? Probably not that hard.
Scrapers have been around for a while. Pulling images for the descent, very, very simple. It's simply a matter of having enough processing power to do that at scale, probably very quickly. You know, you could do that theoretically with a laptop, probably with a modern smartphone. You could actually do that. It'd just be a bit slower than perhaps an enterprise would want it to be. But easily enough, cloud computing, you could do that at scale very, very quickly and just store the images.
And it's something as simple as a database that says, this is this person's name, these are all the photos of their face. There's probably a minimal amount of processing that says, this is a face. Like, they don't want to scrape stuff that's, you know, their dog or where they went on holiday or whatever. I'm also assuming that the tagging elements in Facebook must be at play here as well, because you tag photos in Facebook to say they're you. So I'm assuming that stuff's accessible as well. So it just made their job really easy for them.
Yeah, Facebook's always been able to kind of identify faces like that, hasn't it? When it comes up with a tag suggestion, like, inside, we think this is that person.
Yeah.
And so how do we think that then translates to the trouble that PIMAI have got into? So it says that they've been scraping ancestry and scraping like dead people's images. What do you think of that, Matt? How do you think that then?
Well, PIMAI's worse in my view, because what PIMAI says is if you've got one photo of someone, you can now find all of the photos of that person and identify who they are, which I think is quite terrifying.
The way they market it is it's a way of finding all the photos of you on the internet so you can protect your privacy. Yes. The question though, and this was a question for the Clearview, and Clearview originally were not actually just limited to law enforcement. They actually sold it publicly to members of the public. But then there were significant concerns around stalkers, child abusers, that sort of stuff. PIMAI is probably going to fall afoul of the same concerns, I suspect. Yeah. There's real worries there. But as far as I know, they still do offer a public available query system.
I have a question with all of this. Does this concept of a right to be forgotten, a right to have your data deleted, are we able to put in a Freedom of Information Request Act to PIMAI's, to Clearview, with my face and say, hey, I want to know what pictures you have of me. You have to send them to me. And equally, I would like you to remove me from the system, therefore I can't be found, right? Does that mean criminals could go and remove themselves from the law enforcement databases?
I'm not a lawyer, I'm not an expert on UK law, but I've had a lot of interactions with the GDPR in my past as part of my career. So data subject access requests and the right to be forgotten do apply in certain situations. You cannot ask to be removed from law enforcement, provided law enforcement have a legitimate reason for processing your data. However, organizations such as PIMAI's and Clearview essentially are depending upon the consent of the individual in question. So if you retract that consent, you can ask to be removed. Both Clearview and PIMAI's, I believe, do allow for you to ask for your photos to be taken down. However, their scrapers are still going around the internet, and a couple of people have found they have to be removed. A couple of months later, they've got more photos back up there.
So is the issue more with, not with PIMAI and Clearview AI, but more with the websites that the original image is sourced from? So obviously with PIMAI, what they're trying to do is show you, these are all the images that exist on the internet. You could potentially use that to say, I'm not happy that my image is available, or this particular image is available on this website anymore, and I want to remove it. Could you use it as a way of tracking down your images and saying, I'm going to use this as a way to get rid of all those images? Or is it PIMAI and Clearview that you think are people who are doing the bad thing, when really they're just a tool?
They can only exist because, you know, this is back to the same old thing. This is exactly like the 2016 disinformation stuff, the Cambridge Analytica. So this is the same. It's just faces, right? So instead of asking me to take a quiz and me filling out a quiz that says I'm 61% fun to be with, instead of it doing that, what it's doing is it's taking the pictures that I posted onto Facebook and using that data instead. With my consent. But the challenges are exactly the same. But what's interesting is that you have this situation where individuals make up that data set, but Facebook fundamentally owns that data set, right? Facebook has made each of those individual people the product, and that's why the product is free. You're the product because the thing Facebook sells is your data. And I think lots of people are now aware of that. But to your point, what do you do? You couldn't possibly track every place where you exist, you know, on the internet. I suppose we should talk a bit about the positives. You know, PIMAI's have said that there are lots of useful things that can be done with this, with the results of these searches, things like removing revenge porn, for example, that's ended up in lots of places on the internet, working with humanitarian organizations to help with stopping human trafficking or combating crime, whatever. You know, all these things are obviously useful things, but those aren't to do with an individual being able to see another individual's photos and identify who they are through a search bar on the internet. That feels like a moral, ethical question that needs to be answered. And then now goes back to, well, then how is government involved in protecting privacy? How far are they going to go? And then that then leads directly into things like the legislation being proposed, you know, to protect how the internet's used. And that just becomes a hot potato then that it feels like we never get an answer to.
Exactly. It is the classic. The problem needs to arise before the legislation can be put in place to moderate it and to address the challenge, because before that, legislation can't address a problem that they don't know exists.
But I think to Matt's point, what's more alarming is what can be done at scale fairly easily and where the potential is then for that stuff to be misused. That's the bit I find alarming.
The fact that you could do it from your iPhone, absolutely.
Well, or if you've got the cloud capability, you can scale to billions of images, right?
Yeah, very, very quickly, very, very easily. It's just a case of, have you got enough money to pay the bill for the cloud service at the end of the month?
Yeah, you don't even need necessarily particularly technical expertise to do it.
Technology has become much more accessible to all of us. And unfortunately, that also means that it's more accessible for people with malicious intent as well.
Bot attacks are becoming more frequent, more time-consuming to stop, and cause untold damage to your brand. Thankfully, Netezza Agentless Bot Management detects up to 6 times more threats and stops bots automatically. Block more bad bots. Go to netezza.com.
That takes us really nicely, Matt, onto our next topic of ticket scalping. So you're speaking there about the low barrier to entry for malicious actors who are trying to execute attacks. So ticket scalping, it is so easy for anybody to go onto a website, purchase the bot and run it. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about how that works? And then we'll go into why this has become such a challenge for those high demand ticket items like Eurovision and Taylor Swift and any other myriad of popular event.
Absolutely. So bots, those are automated processes running over the internet, essentially, are run largely by tools. You've probably downloaded apps onto your phone. You probably install programs onto your computer. A lot of these bots work in exactly the same way. You buy the bot online, usually a digital download, install it onto your computer and load it up. And some of them require a bit more technical expertise than others to run. Some assume some technical knowledge, but you've got sort of what I consider sort of entry-level bots as well. To give you an idea, there is a credential stuffing tool that we see very widely used. This is a tool used specifically to take over accounts en masse, accounts on streaming services, retail stores, that sort of thing. And it is eminently possible for someone to go, I want to take over 10,000 accounts on this retail store. And within 20 minutes of just making that decision, with no technical expertise, they can download all the tools, set it all up and run it, purely using the available tools online that are easily found on Google searches and using the freely available handy user guides that come with them. The scalper bot market is very similar. You've got tools, some of them are free, some of them are very, very expensive. We see them running into $5,000-$6,000 in price, sometimes even more, which tells you something about the amount of money these people make from this sort of thing, mm-hmm. that they can afford to outlay that much as a business expense. And what you do is you simply download the tool, point it at the target you want to try and scalp, say Eurovision tickets, and hit run. And away you go.
And so lots of dark web suppliers, you might call them, or vendors are supplying this service to anybody with access to Google, essentially. And so what does that mean then for the future of people wanting to buy those high demand tickets, do you think? So if we've got like the Eurovision popping up again, or say Ed Sheeran tickets go on tour, do you think it's going to be absolutely necessary for people to purchase a bot to get those tickets? Because if not, they're looking at, say, £11,000 per ticket in some cases, perhaps more.
I think it's possibly the way it's going to go. We saw that with the PlayStation 5 launch, where I work in detecting bots, and so many other people I know wanted to get a PS5. They're like, Matt, what is the best bot to use to get a PS5? Because I can't compete with the scalpers. So I was being asked, you know, I need a bot that will get around this company's defenses. And I'm sure you know which one it was. I was like, I do, I'm telling you. Because that is not helping the problem. But essentially, that's what it's becoming of. It's almost an arms race where people with legitimate concerns have to use a bot to try and keep up. So in response, unfortunately, the sort of slippery slope of that is, hey, I just used a bot. Why not just buy a couple more tickets and sell them at, you know, like you said, 11 grand, mm-hmm. I'll make 10 grand profit.
Absolutely. And obviously, then you've got economic factors in play there as well. So obviously, we're in like a credit crisis and the temptation must be there. Absolutely must be there. Okay, so why do you think that now we've only started to just see people being prosecuted for these attacks? So obviously, the Bots Act has been in place since 2016. Tom, do you want to take this?
Yeah, I mean, look, this is nothing new. Ticket touts were around before PS5s. We saw the shift of a lot of the actors that are involved in the ticketing space and touting tickets and scalping tickets move online during the pandemic because of the lack of events. These were the original people that built the tools that we use to scalp PS5s and then sneakers and so on. You know, they're not new. They've been around for ages. I think the reason we're seeing this is obviously the act was released, but there is simply, you know, the act is too much of a grey area to really prosecute anyone. It doesn't put too much of a penalty on the people selling the tickets or an emphasis for them to do much. But what we have seen is just the power of Taylor Swift's fan club. Mm. That is the single and only reason that that is so high profile is the organization and the structure of the Taylor Swift fan club in trying to take action against this and the outrage that they had. They're not the first group of fans to be outraged. They're not the last group of fans to be outraged. They're the most organized and best run fan club that are trying to take action.
What it does, I think, though, is it creates a template for others to be able to follow, because the only way that you're going to combat a threat at scale, and it is a threat, what consumers, I think, have to do, and I think governments have to help them do it, is they have to scale as well. So if you're being defeated by scale, you as a group, whether you're the Taylor Swift fan club or whether you're Ed Sheeran's fan club or whether you're, you know, Eurovision super fans, pressure has to be created to force governments to think about how they go about solving this problem. I think the other thing that I find really interesting about it is it clearly reflects really badly on the brands involved, whether it's tickets or other high demand items. It reflects badly on those brands. If Taylor Swift is the brand, she recognises and her management recognise that it reflects badly on her. So there is an incentive for them to do something about it. And there are other artists who have also spoken, Ed Sheeran is one of them, who have spoken out in the context of this is a fiasco, right? Yeah. But it'll only be fixed, I think, by consumer and public pressure, forcing governments to, whether we like it or not, regulate better how things are priced and sold. Because the way that we transact has changed, I mean, unrecognizably, even just, let's say, in the last 10 years, do we believe that consumer protections have kept pace with those changes? No, right? No one's going to say yes. So that's what's got to happen. And I think also those organizations have a responsibility to take in terms of how they look at stopping those bots doing that stuff. Because the only thing that will incentivize them to do that is where it is to their advantage. And you might argue that at the moment, it's not, right?
Yeah.
The resale sites exist. The ticket is bought. The transaction's done. The retailer steps back and says, well, I've done my bit now. And then the ticket ends up on a resale site because of the entire resale market. For context, recent research from Forbes says that items being scalped by bots is a $16 billion industry. That is not helping the consumer. I don't think anyone can argue that's helping.
And the reason it's thriving is because there is no adequate legislation to actually moderate this, because there isn't the understanding in the legal system to address it.
There's also the difficulty of it's very international. So we track groups who scalp all over the world and just move the goods across international borders. I mean, it gets very difficult to, you know, if we're sat here in the UK and we see a scalping attack against a UK organization, and then it's being perpetrated by, you know, someone somewhere else on another continent, it suddenly gets very, very difficult for the UK government to go, okay, am I actually going to pursue that actor?
Yeah.
You know, is it expensive to get to go for extradition and you have to go through all the legal proceedings? Is it actually worth it for a concert ticket?
How proactive could I be about stopping a bot? Now, I know one of the things they've tried doing is raffles, but that doesn't work either, does it?
So I think the only thing the consumer can do is to not buy on the secondary marketplaces, which is easier said than done. But the minute consumers stop doing that, the problem goes away. It will never happen. I wish it would. I wish we could all start buying tickets on secondary sites. But that's the only thing realistically the consumer can do. I think also there's a lot of talk at the moment, and I actually feel in some way sorry for the ticketing companies, which I don't think anyone would ever expect me to say. having been in this space and having worked in large volume on sales for nearly 10 years now, ticketing is one of the lowest margin industries in the marketplace, right? So all these people talking about how we've got all this security and they should have bank grade security and bank grade verification. You know, banks are making 6 to 10 times more margin than the ticketing companies. Number one, the margin isn't in the ticketing ecosystem to fund that kind of level of security protection that we'd expect from a bank account. Equally, all of the other industries that tend to say that the ticket industry is messing this up, ticketing is the highest volume, highest traffic event space in the world. Most websites, most businesses, even banks couldn't cope with the surges in traffic that ticketing sites see. So when a ticketing site is hit, they need to offload that ticket quickly, simply to keep their website online. Equally, what a lot of people don't understand is the ecosystem behind the allocation of tickets. Tickets go out in allocations. The site that sells the tickets the fastest gets the next allocation. Because as much as all these artists talk about wanting to get their tickets in the hands of the fans, and I genuinely believe that, they equally don't want to have that event that doesn't sell out. Mm-hmm. They want to have something that sells out quickly. So it's a really complex and diverse problem that isn't easy to solve. I think one thing ticketing companies could do is not have their own secondary marketplaces that also sell them directly. I mean, if I was an artist, you should just not give your tickets to those people. But there's monopolies and everything at play here, right?
When you're talking about the margin, what is the... It feels like event tickets are more expensive than ever. So that, are we saying that the margin is low because so many people are taking a cut? Is the margin low because the production values of a Taylor Swift concert are so incredibly high? Like, what is the...
I'm just talking very high level. If you look at the profits that an average bank would make on their consumer and their customer to what a ticketing platform would make, you know, they do make billions of pounds, right? They're not short of cash, right? The government could never implement the same regulation on that industry with the revenue they make per customer as they do on a bank, per se. It would be unbusiness-minded, I guess, is the way we've seen. We've actually seen people from the government say they don't want to step in on this because it's business. Mm-hmm. You know, these people selling tickets are making money. They are paying tax. There are businesses around this. There are people employed. There are secondary marketing sites that make money, that pay taxes, that hire people. Mm-hmm. You know, we have seen the Department of Trade in the UK not want to step in on this because they don't want to be seen to be restricting business, because they view secondary ticketing sales as business, right?
Well, but the question to ask there would be, though, but why does that secondary market exist? It can only exist for a handful of reasons, can't it? Someone can't go to a concert. I mean, actually, that's probably, isn't it? What are the other reasons for the resale market to exist?
Yes. There are a great number of businesses now that offer secondary ticket and verified fan platforms where you can sell your ticket at the same fair price to guaranteed fans, right? So they're out there.
There definitely are. There are some really great websites that do it. And even just say, right, you've got a certain amount of time. So you've got 6 hours and within which this ticket will be available to you on a resale site. So there are fair ways of doing it. Mm. And the question is just definitely, how is that actually moderated? And again, that ethical question of, okay, so if one reseller can do it, how do you stop another reseller from doing it in the wrong way? And what constitutes the wrong way versus the correct way and a fair way to do it?
But you're mentioning bank grade stuff. I mean, is one of the gates that could be put in place KYC at the point of a purchase over a certain amount? And this goes back to what I was saying about how the way we're buying things has changed. So if you're buying a high demand item, should the website be able to ask, right, now I need to validate that you're a real person? You're going to have to show me your face. We're going to have to do two-factor. We're going to have to show me ID. And once you've done that, you can't, you know, you've bought your sneakers or your ticket and you can't buy again.
But if you're looking to spend thousands of pounds, that might be something that people are more willing to do.
There is also, though, the issue with that, the KYC has been bypassed. And in particular, the scalping industry does have issues with some links to organized crime. Scalping is a great way to launder money. If you want to get rid of some money fast and maybe even double, triple, quadruple your investment, it's a good way to do it. And we see all the time people offering bypasses for KYC processes, most of which involve mocking up fake pictures of, you know, you hold up your passport to a camera with your face next to it and they mock up a fake passport and identity for you. And we're also, you know, we see all sorts of complaints on social media forums and so forth, where people complain that I went to register with this site that has a KYC process. Apparently, I've already got an account.
Yeah.
So, your data has unfortunately been stolen. Someone's created a fake identity in your name and has already registered with the site.
Yeah, and the challenge is bigger than just the actual validation of the purchase of the ticket, right? We see that there are tens of thousands of pounds involved in the markup of some of these tickets, right? So to validate that the guy who's buying it isn't a scalper, very hard. Like, I could be a ticket tout, I could buy that ticket, I could prove it's me. There is then so much margin that when we've seen this before, they will walk up to the concert or whatever with the people that have got tickets with them and get in and then leave because they've made their money. Equally, you know, if they don't want to go, they can give the person a printed card with a limited balance so they've got the same card to check. And the challenge is putting these in-depth checks on an event where you've got to get thousands of people in a safe manner. There just isn't the time. you know, if they're lucky, they might be able to check that the ticket that they've got corresponds to your driving license. And how many people turn up and say, I bought it for my wife, sorry, she's not here. Like, you know, there isn't the time at the gates to conduct these strict checks. And even if there is, sometimes there's the ticket tout for walking in with them anyway.
Not when you've got security checks and everything to prioritise. I think of those, especially the bigger venues. Matt, you took us very nicely onto social media earlier. So you spoke about how your information can be used to create a new profile. So one of our big topics for discussion today is the Russian influencer bots and how bots are being used to boost the presence of influencers by creating bot-driven profiles. So can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So bots are used quite extensively on services such as Instagram and other social media profiles. Twitter, obviously, there was quite a lot of discussions about the number of bots on Twitter as Elon Musk was taking over the site. It became a very expensive issue for a lot of people, I believe. You also have Instagram as well. You know, people are often accused of having fake followers and this sort of thing. And that all comes down to bots, essentially fake profiles that are set up quickly, easily, and people essentially sell the services of that to specific influencers. So we've actually found in some countries, there are literally vending machines where you can go to, you put in your profile information, you know, what your profile handle is or whatever, and put in a bit of cash and you can add, say, 1,000 followers or 100 likes onto your most recent post, things like that.
Absolutely madness.
It must cause, you and Chris probably know more about this than me, but I imagine it must cause absolute chaos for the marketing industry when you can't tell if someone actually has legitimate followers or not when you're trying to choose to hire an influencer.
Well, so I can tell you of examples in our industry where startup cybersecurity companies that might come out of Eastern Europe suddenly have 10,000 LinkedIn followers, and yet every time they post an update, it's only the 50 people who work at that company who like any of those posts or who are engaging. So yes, it's obvious that it happens. I find this happening on Twitter, though, way more interesting, because my understanding is, from what we know about Russian disinformation going way back to 2016, is that they basically create en masse accounts, not just for the purposes of following, but also for the purposes of posting updates that look to reinforce particular ways of thinking or particular views, fake news, whatever. I'm really interested to know, what are the practicalities of that? Like, how are they doing that? Is it just people? Is it purely people? Like, are they actual bots? How are the statuses created? Like, how do they make sure that they change so that they don't get recognized by as being bots? Like,
and can we loop that back to our previous conversation about AI? Are we expecting now that AI is in place? Is this problem only going to get worse? If you've got ChatGPT as well as these swathes of fake accounts that you can automate the content, you can just say, I want to say XYZ about this politician, about this theory, about this issue. That has limitless potential, presumably.
Essentially, yes. So misinformation campaigns have long been a part of both Russia and the West's operations. Yeah. You know, it does apply to both sides. Obviously, Russia's... we're the good guys. No, but yeah, Russia's very, very aggressive around disinformation. Mm-hmm. And the Vulcan Files leaks recently showed very clearly that activities such as attacks on critical national infrastructure, the sort of attacks that we saw a few years ago in Ukraine that knocked out power stations and that sort of thing, those sorts of attacks are seen very much in the same way as disinformation campaigns, as a way of sapping the will to fight of a target country, trying to discourage the population, make them think their government's not capable of protecting them.
Yeah.
So in Russian military doctrine, they sort of fit together, those sorts of things. Disinformation is not really distinguished from, perhaps you might call them, slightly harder cyber attacks with a more physical impact. However, what we did see from the Vulcan Files as well is that there's a lot of effort and many systems have been built and designed specifically for the purposes of pushing disinformation. They have tactics and techniques, training methods for people to use to learn how to try and manipulate public opinion. And a lot of this is based around the idea of, one, understanding what public opinion is, both within Russia and outside of it in other countries as well, monitoring essentially simple sentiments and analysis, as, you know, ML models have been doing for a while now. Monitor to understand who are the biggest troublemakers, what is the general overruling opinion, and then creating swarms of fake accounts, fake profiles, using things, to go back to that harvesting of images, often using images harvested off the internet of other real people, attaching them to profiles completely unrelated to that person, and then pushing specific messages, pushing ideas. And these can either be controlled by an individual if you want a very precise sort of message, or again, like you said, ChatGPT, AI, ML, these can all be used to try and generate messages to try and push a particular point of view. Again, very, very quickly. And with ChatGPT, you can see how fast that is.
Yeah.
You just roll that constantly.
Different applications as well. Like you can, there are bits of software that can create AI faces for you. So now you don't even need steal faces anymore. Can create faces. You can create the post. And I was reading in some of the Vulkan file stuff that also they scale up mobile phones, right? So that you can sign up for an account. So they got these machines that have 320 SIM cards in, which basically mean that you can sign up for 320 Twitter accounts at a time. And then all you're doing is telling a bot to automate the posts. The posts match the sentiment. The posts are designed to either retweet or to engage with the right kinds of people. I can't imagine that it takes you that long to be able to create a groundswell of feeling that isn't actually real feeling at all. And the way that human beings operate is there is a herd mentality amongst human beings. It's a psychological effect. And so once that's applied effectively, you can begin to take an entire group of potentially millions of real people with you. And that's how the Russians are going about spreading disinformation. I suppose the next question would be, well, how do you combat that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the first bit, the key bit, is we're talking about just Twitter. This problem is far greater than Twitter. If you read some of the analyst stuff on the Vulkan files, they call it a fire hose of disinformation, right? It's not just about Twitter, but part of the strategy is about this disinformation coming from at volume, from multiple people across multiple channels, right? Not just Twitter, but Facebook, other social media, chat rooms, forums.
Sections of newspapers.
It goes far broader because I think, you know, what they proved was, you know, if you just see it on Twitter, you're like, oh, Twitter's got this crazy narrative. If I see the same narrative in the comments and the news, I see it in forums, I see it when I'm chatting someone on a chat room, it's far more powerful. So I think the problem is the same, right? But it goes far deeper than Twitter. And, you know, more often than not, we just talk about Twitter as the focal point. I think part of the power of this Russian attack is it's far broader than just Twitter.
Anywhere where supposed public opinion can be broadcast or and can be upvoted in some cases, that is a target for disinformation, isn't it? Because in some cases, if you're talking about the right kinds of newspaper, you know, the right kinds of publications on the internet, for example, it's reinforcing opinions, it's reinforcing bias, and it's doing that through using machinery, which is, you know, we could have a discussion about propaganda machinery from almost 100 years ago, but now we're talking about it in the context of, you know, the sort of volume that they're capable of. I think, again, it presents a similar sort of challenge to the ticketing one, right? How is a newspaper, and does a newspaper care, does the comment section of the Daily Mail, do they care who writes something in there? How moderated is that?
And well, it's worse than that, right? Because we see this all the time. How do we measure these social media businesses? What is the success for a social media business? There's probably a marketing person just like you, Chris, there, looking at account growth, engagement growth. Yes. So these are good stats. Do these companies ever want to make creating an account hard? No. Do they want to encourage as many accounts as possible? Yes. Do they want to encourage as much dialogue as possible, even if it is confrontational, right? So there's someone that's a bit noisy on the chat room that encourages more people to chat and argue with them. All of those stats are typically the stats that these businesses, when we measure them at a business level, are things that we look for as positive things.
Is the thing that created a storm around bots at Twitter was more to do with the fact that high-profile individuals and celebrities were like, something's up here because I'm getting follows from a lot of accounts that clearly aren't real. And so the pressure was actually created by the super users, I suppose, as opposed to the individual with, you know, 100 followers or whatever. And so then it became an issue because of that, not necessarily because a social media organization actually wants to fix that problem, but because there's pressure from their users.
Yeah, and I think then that raises the question of where does responsibility lie for the problem? Because is it with the social media platforms? Does there need to be a bigger legislator involved saying we're completely agnostic to the situation, whether it's the individual users, whether it's a business, whether it's a social media platform, then there does need to be something put in place. But like I say, who can actually challenge that and have, without there being a business benefit in place?
I think, though, we have to, similarly to the ticketing issue, we have to be somewhat fair to the businesses. You know, they are trying to run a business. to expect them to be able to stand up to what is essentially a military operation that's targeting them is perhaps a little bit unreasonable. You know, they do not have the resources that a military do. They don't have the money. They don't have the even the knowledge. Yeah. The cybersecurity tools and so forth that governments have that just do not make it into the public. We're just not aware of. And of course, any changes or security they implement, there is a big pile of money, literally thousands of people working to try and get back around that as fast as possible. And you throw enough money and time as a problem, sooner or later, you're probably going to fix it.
Yeah. I think the only thing we can do as people and often as parents is educate children and everyone on where they get their information from and how to, you know.
I think children need a lot less education than my mum. Because if my mum reads it on Facebook, she will share it with everyone before she's checked anything. She has no filter for what could or could not be disinformation, because in the mind of that generation, it's published. It's published in a place. I've read it. It's literally in black and white. It must be real. It must be fact. So I think actually younger generations are more suspicious about where things come from than that older generation who is more involved in social media, probably less ready. And I think, to take the Russian actions as an example, I think they have taken advantage of that. I think if you looked at the kind of people more ready to engage with that stuff, they would be of that older generation.
And perhaps really those that they're trying to influence that are more likely to, say, vote, for instance.
Mm, yeah.
The voting age.
There's also the drowning out effect. So this is something we saw with the, was it the Arab uprisings and the Spring uprisings. Yeah, there was a lot of efforts to suppress dissenting opinions, mm-hmm. not necessarily through sentiment analysis and so forth, but simply by commenting so often, you push their comments onto page 3 or 4. Has anyone ever gone to like the page 3 or 4 of Google search? I'm not sure they have. Once you've hit page 2, you realize I'm not finding the answers I want here, sort of thing. You know, in comments pages, as much as saying, you know, you tend not to read too far down. If you push certain opinions far enough down, people may not even get to them. Some organizations obviously benefit a lot more from a more passionate debate. They want more of, Tom was saying, that engagement, and they try to encourage that sort of very polarizing opinions. Others, however, do try to moderate the forums and try to keep them under control. But it varies from organization to organization. But even on the ones that are perhaps more restrictive, I remember seeing one that's quite restrictive, a major UK news source. And I saw during the invasion of Ukraine, there was a couple of people pushing a very pro-Kremlin point of view called James Charles and Charles James. And I remember laughing that your name generator messed up a bit there, didn't it?
What gets scary is where this is going, right? When we talk about, yes, we've all talked about disinformation, fake information, you know, people being smart, being able to spot where it's coming from, right? If we look at the sophistication of, you know, the fraud that we've seen recently, where people are using real people's voices, trained by AI, to ring family members and, you know, tell them and extort money. We've seen videos of celebrities that look exactly like that celebrity. We will move to a place, right, where surely, you know, Russia and other nations will be able to make videos of people that you know and trust, that sound like them, that look like them, that spread disinformation, that will be very nearly possible, if not impossible, to actually validate if it's real or not.
Yeah, and surely where they have the means, it's not just about things like disinformation, it's also then about cybercrime, isn't it? Where you have the means and the target is big enough, is it worth me faking KYC to be able to intercept a deposit for a house, for example? Yeah, it's totally worth it. It's hundreds of thousands of pounds. Yeah, it's totally worth my investment. And so where the technology exists, surely, and I don't like being a doom monger, but surely we're headed to a place where those technologies will be applied to everything.
Oh, I mean, the other day I was told Jeremy Clarkson was arrested for pushing the best and fastest growing cryptocurrency. He was taken down by the government, and I saw tons of images of Clarkson recommended this cryptocurrency, which clearly I don't think Clarkson's in pushing cryptocurrency.
The farming's not working out for him then. Yeah. I mean, the invasion of Ukraine, there was a video popularized on YouTube of Zelensky, a deep fake, ordering the surrender of Ukrainian troops, which didn't stick, fortunately. But, you know, that was an early stage test of what could well become a powerful weapon for militaries to spread disinformation.
The examples that are in the consciousness now around AI and deepfake are extreme. And so therefore, because they're extreme, we can tell that they're fake. Whereas actually what's interesting is almost certainly where they're being actually applied, they are clearly not extreme. They're very normal and they are designed to look real and not make you think, is this real or not? Therefore, it must be happening. And then the question will become, how do we stop it? I suppose in the post-truth age, let's say beyond 2016, have we just got comfortable with the fact that we now have to apply our brains to doing our own filtering on what we believe is real or not? And how important do we think that is to us? Yes, I would argue. But then the question becomes, at what point is it problematic enough that something needs to change?
Yeah, because I think that comes back to your point earlier about there being a generational issue for those who are technologically adept versus those who are not. For instance, my dad had a phishing email that came from an account posing as me. And yeah, I had a text from him saying, I can't access those photos. I said, I haven't sent you any photos. It would only come through WhatsApp. Do not open that email. Yeah. Do not open those pictures. And he was just like, oh, I've been repeatedly clicking. I was like, oh, fabulous. And so it's having the education to say, am I suspicious of this? So I think you're correct that it is going to come down to the individual users. But at what point does there need to be a greater authority kind of step in and say, as a society, we need to be this aware. We need to educate everybody to say, this is what real looks like. This is what faith looks like. Oh, they're exactly the same. You need to make sure that you're looking for those more subtle indicators in your any communication that either comes to you or anything that, I suppose, crosses your path, particularly virtually or across social media, because not everybody knows to do it.
And what's more alarming for us, I suppose, is that we've talked about how AI could begin to enable these things at scale, but we've also talked about how automation is already doing these things at scale. The capability for all these things to happen at scale makes them, by definition, a bigger problem. It'll be interesting to understand what the tipping point is. I think the next US election will be extremely interesting. I think what plays out in Ukraine will be extremely interesting. And I think that, you know, it may be that bigger questions start to be asked geopolitically about, you know, how disinformation can really be tackled. Not inspiring when I was reading articles this week that were basically saying the results of models like ChatGPT are impossible to identify as being from ChatGPT. So that just for me looks like a massive red flag that says we can't actually detect the results of AI. Are any of us worried about that?
Are any of us not worried about that? Great. Well, thank you all for that sterling conversation. I think we got into some healthy debate there about some of the cybersecurity issues that are challenging absolutely everybody today.
Detect, stop, protect. That's NetAsea's ethos when it comes to stopping bot attacks. And it should be your ethos too. Because who has time to stop billions of automated threats? NetAsea does, up to 6 times more effectively than the competition. Block bad bots for good. Visit netasea.com.
So to sum up, I'd like to go, sorry, Matt, back to you with one more question. Would you like to talk to us about the bot of the month, which we have elected this month to be card cracking?
Certainly. So card cracking is a rather simple technique that sort of falls in line with brute forcing, where you make thousands and thousands of guesses to try and get the right answer. Usually when we talk about brute forcing, we talk about breaking into people's online accounts. You know, you can get a list of, say, the 100,000 most common passwords. You can try and guess those. Credit card cracking works in a very similar fashion. Say you have either no information or partial information about a credit card. Say you have just the number. You don't have the expiry date or the little 3-digit code on the back. So you want to try and guess those remaining artifacts, trying to steal someone's credit card, essentially. What you do is you go to a merchant site or a retail site, or as we've increasingly seen attackers doing, you go to several and diversify across several. One store may notice a sudden request by someone to make 4,000 purchases. They're less likely to notice if it's 10. Mm-hmm. You know, if you usually make 200 sales a day and you're suddenly making 4,000 in 10 minutes, you're probably going to get a bit suspicious. If you usually make 40 a day, you suddenly make 10 in an hour or 11 in an hour, you're going to be less suspicious. That's probably, oh, you just had a slight burst of business. Great. So what they do is they spread it across multiple sites and they basically just throw, trying to guess the missing digits using automated tools. So someone sits at home with their laptop, essentially sets all of this up to run and goes, guess all the possible permutations of this number and throw it against these sites. Eventually, they will get from that a list of accurate details, which they can then use as a refined list and either use themselves or more commonly sell on to other criminals who know, I can then use these numbers. They are accurate, and for certain amounts of money, usually up to a limit, I can use them without triggering any detections because they got through previously.
And so whose responsibility do you think it is to try and prevent card cracking, or to try and, I suppose, mitigate the impact of card cracking? Do you think it comes down to the retailer, the card provider, the payment gateway, or does it need to be, as we've discussed a lot today, does it need to be much more at a legislative level?
I think that's something everyone can do to an extent. I don't think it's necessarily my responsibility trying, you know, someone guessing a random number that happens to be my credit card, but I should certainly be paying attention to my credit card statements. Mm. The number of times I've heard people say, hey, I had someone commit fraud on my account 12 months ago. Probably should have caught that a bit quicker, realistically, rather than letting it build up over months and months.
Yeah.
You know, you have to a degree, as harsh as it is, you have to say to people, you know, take some responsibility and initiative in protecting yourself. The internet is a wild west. You do have to look after yourself. Companies, you know, they should be monitoring for automated activity, suspicious activity, that sort of thing. Again, credit card companies can do the same, and payment gateways as well. Payment gateways and credit card providers, though, also have a bit more insight than the merchants. As I mentioned, merchants are often, it's 10 to 1, 10 to another, 10 to another, not 4,000 to 1. So what you're looking at from the merchant's perspective is much harder to detect than, say, a payment gateway that may actually have multiple merchants all going through them. They should be looking for anomalies, aberrations in patterns, something suspicious going on. Similarly, banks as well, well, they have very thorough checks. You know, as you mentioned, Tom was mentioning earlier, there's a lot of legislation around them already. Mm-hmm. But again, they need to be, I think, more aggressive in terms of trying to block purchases made with credit cards they think are suspicious. And I think as consumers, we need to be more forgiving of that. I've fallen for that in the past as well. My credit card gets blocked, purchase gets blocked, I get quite annoyed. But at the end of the day, they're actually doing it for my benefit. And a 2-minute phone call is a lot better than me losing 20 grand.
Oh, absolutely.
The mechanics of this are the numbers that they are inventing effectively with some algorithm, I guess, that fills in the spaces. Are they actually being tested for a purchase and then declined? Is that how it's working?
That's how it works in most cases, yes.
Right. So there must be masses of declines that are happening against those payment gateways while they're going through this process.
Yes. Okay. The issue goes through what we call target diversification. So the payment gateway sees, say, 2 or 3 bad requests from one merchant, and then 2 or 3 from a different one, and from different one. Unless they're tying that all that information together, they're not likely to detect it. If they're seeing each merchant as an individual entity rather than the all of the payment requests they're getting as a group, they're less likely to detect it.
And I suppose that then what they're looking for is they're looking to use those cards in places where, or do they already have the user's personal information to make that card work? Or sometimes they don't need that.
Quite often you don't need that.
Right.
What we see attackers often advertising is methods for bypassing sort of BIN requirements and that sort of thing. So they advertise, oh, here's a list of credit cards you can use on this site up to this amount without triggering security.
So they know what the floor is, basically.
Yeah, often through, again, trial and error.
Yeah. Right.
The aim of the game is to go undetected for as long as possible. So if you're not, like you said earlier, if you're not checking your statement for 12 months, then you're extremely high risk, because that's exactly the game they're playing. They're relying on you not checking.
And do they just keep doing this? They move to different sites and they just keep producing, they're effectively producing card numbers that they're then selling on dark markets or whatever.
Quite effectively, yes. Though we also see attackers pulling information from data dumps. So what often these attacks are doing, they look at data dump, they pull off, say, some companies be breached, their customers' credit card details have been leaked. Obviously, they don't store the full collection of data, so the criminal doesn't have the full collection. They pull that information, plug it into their tool, and fire it off against a few hundred, maybe 1,000 merchants.
Scary. Tom, is there anything you want to add? Because I know you've worked with a number of retailers over the years who have suffered from card cracking or very similar challenges.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting challenge for everyone in the space. I think quite often what we see is a retailer is often suffering because it's really the payment gateway that's being targeted. I think interestingly, what we didn't really touch on there is some of the pains that can cause for the retailer. So a lot of these gateways will have throughput limits. So they might be at a key trading period, it'll be a busy shopping period. And if they've got a lot of fake card registrations going through at the same time, they might start to see that, oh, well, actually, some customers aren't able to verify their cards and check out. Some customers pay per validation as well, so they're actually being charged a fee for all of these attacks. And, you know, we've seen people suffer significant losses because of effectively paying to validate stolen credit cards. Equally, some of these have throughput limits that just shut them off. So you'll see websites go down where you can't shop anymore because, you know, the payment gateway knows they're being targeted and shuts them off. So it can be a very destructive attack for a lot of online businesses, and it can really sort of stop their revenue generation for a period, if not a longer period of time.
Thank you, Tom. Well, again, I'd like to thank you all for joining us on episode one of series two of the Cybersecurity Sessions. It's been great to be back in action. So if anybody has any questions that they'd like to send over to any of our panelists, so Matt, Chris, or Tom, please do send them to either our Twitter accounts at cybersecpod, or please email them to podcast@netazir.com. For now, thank you very much, everyone. Goodbye, and we look forward to meeting up with you again in next month's episode.